The Trump administration has removed Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro. His regime is still in place, but President Trump has threatened further military action.
Like a sort of Damocles hanging over Venezuela, making sure that it does what the U.S. wants.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today we hear from people in Venezuela about what they're going through. Also on the show,
China's soft power is growing, just as America's soft power is being destroyed.
One prediction about global politics in 2026.
And keeping an old tradition alive for today on the 12th day of Christmas.
Basically, neighbors get to go and visit other neighbors and sing to them. There's very few times in our current culture where we get to do that.
Still caroling and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. We're going to start off today with the big story resonating around the globe. Venezuela's deposed president, Nicolas Maduro, who appeared in a Manhattan courtroom earlier today. He's now facing drug-related charges after being snatched from Caracas in a U.S. military operation over the weekend. Maduro entered a plea of not guilty.
Venezuela has been through a lot of upheaval over the years. Political repression and an economic collapse pushed millions of people there to flee. But Venezuela is now entering a new moment of great uncertainty. The World's TV's Isaiah spoke with people in the capital about how they're living through it.
Gaby León was at her home in Catia, a poor neighborhood in Caracas, when the sounds woke her.
Y se escucharon las primeras tres explosiones muy cerca de nosotros.
We heard the first three explosions very close to us, she says. She ran outside and saw helicopters flying unusually low.
Comenzaron a sobrevolar muy bajo.
She and her neighbors were terrified.
Sentimos muchísimo miedo y mucha incertidumbre porque no sabíamos qué estaba pasando.
A lot of fear and uncertainty because we didn't know what was happening, she says. Hours later, she learned through social media that the U.S. had launched a military operation and captured President Nicolás Maduro and his wife.
Pero obviamente se sintió una euforia generalizada con la noticia de que habían sacado a Maduro del país. Eso
she says there was a sense of euphoria among her neighbors when they heard Maduro had fallen. But that feeling was contained very quickly, she says. Venezuelans have lived under one-party rule for nearly three decades, with growing repression in recent years. By mid-morning, León says her neighborhood felt quiet and tense. A doctor who asked not to be named for safety reasons described a city that looked normal but didn't feel normal.
Está todo tranquilo, todo sin eventualidades. No hay atascos, no es que haya impedimentos.
Everything looks calm, he says. People were still shopping, filling gas tanks, noticing small military patrols.
La principal emoción es cautela. Creo que hay que tener cautela, prudencia.
The main feeling is caution. We still have to be very careful, he says, because the old regime members are still in power. Later that day, President Trump dismissed opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. And that was very shocking, he says.
I think it would be very tough for her to be the leader. She doesn't have the support within or the respect within the country. She's a very nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect to be the leader.
Machado is the face of Venezuela's democratic movement, and her movement is believed to have won a presidential election last year. The doctor, who supports Machado, says that stung.
Obviamente no me gustó cómo la minimizó.
He didn't like the way Trump minimized her, but he says he also understands what the Trump administration is doing.
Entendí que lo que está buscando el gobierno de Trump es no desestabilizar el país.
They're trying to avoid destabilizing the country, he says. Machado may have popular support, he says, but not the power to control a country whose institutions are broken and whose military still answers to the old system. That system now has a new face. Vice President Delcy Rodríguez has emerged as Venezuela's de facto leader. She's a longtime insider, a close ally of Hugo Chavez and Nicolás Maduro, and until now has run the country's oil and finance sectors. David Smildy is a Venezuela expert at Tulane University.
She's something sort of a modern autocrat or modern authoritarian that wants a country that is relatively open and that, you know, has open markets at the same time that it will repress and restrict political liberties when it needs to.
He says the Trump administration sees Rodriguez as someone it can work with, especially on oil, even if she represents continuity, not change. On Sunday, Delcy Rodriguez shifted her tone.
Presidente, las retomo. Estamos dispuestos a relaciones de respeto.
Just a day after demanding Nicolás Maduro's return, she invited the United States to work with her government, calling for cooperation and coexistence. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. would keep military pressure and an oil embargo in place to force Rodriguez to cooperate with the U.S.
As a threat, like a sword of Damocles, hanging over Venezuela, making sure that it does what the U.S. wants.
David Smiley says the U.S. is not committed to the nation-building process needed to ensure democracy. And some locals find that unsettling. Taxi driver Antonio Andrade says he doesn't support the U.S. attack and fears oil sanctions could be devastating for the Venezuelan people. There were some sparsely attended protests in different cities demanding the U.S. return Nicolás Maduro. But for others, there is still a sense of possibility.
Siento que no había otra forma de sacar a Maduro de la presidencia que no fuese militar, que no fuese.
I feel there was no other way to remove Maduro from power except through military action, León says. The Venezuelan doctor in Caracas says he trusts the U.S. to help guide a transition, even if it's driven by U.S. interests.
Y pienso que por ahí se puede abrir una ventana. Si hay algún cambio, algunas concesiones.
This could open a window for real change. And 3 days ago, he says, that kind of hope was just an illusion. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Miami.
It wasn't that long ago when Venezuela was seen as one of the bright spots for democracy in Latin America. That started to unravel a decade or so ago after the transition from President Hugo Chavez to his successor, Nicolas Maduro. The economic decline and increasing authoritarianism of Maduro spurred 8 million people to flee Venezuela in recent years. Hannah Dreyer reported from Venezuela through many years of the Maduro regime and was a frequent guest on The World. She's now an investigative reporter with the New York Times. When we reconnected today, I asked her about the conditions in Venezuela that caused roughly a quarter of the population to leave.
People, I think, have just really lost hope over the last several years that there's going to be any change there. I was there for sort of the start of this really dramatic humanitarian collapse when Venezuela went from being basically a middle-class country with a lot of educated people, a lot of oil wealth, to being one of the poorest, one of the most really ravaged countries in the region.
So you first began reporting from Venezuela in 2014. That was when the exodus really kind of began. Why were people bolting at that particular moment?
Chavez had just died. Maduro had just taken power.
Hugo Chavez, the first socialist president.
Yes, the very popular first president who sort of came and ushered in the socialist revolution there. And people initially, I think, were waiting to see what happened with Maduro, whether things might at least stay the same, whether he might be ousted from power. But instead, there was just this almost immediate total economic collapse. And so when I was there, one of the first words I learned was despedida, goodbye party. And just every weekend you would go to these goodbye parties, see the same people, you'd say, okay, see you at the next one. Next weekend it would be the same group. People were looking for a way out, or people would give up and just try to live their lives, ignore politics, but there was no way to work. And so I think while I was there, there was just less and less room for people to sort of live their lives.
I mean, it was hard to ignore politics. I mean, there was a socialist revolution that had been started by Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, president from 1999 until his death in 2013. How was he remembered in your time in Venezuela? Like, what was the meaning of that whole political system for the majority of Venezuelans?
When I first arrived in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez was still completely revered by, really, I'd say, a majority of the population. There were always a lot of people who hated Chavez and saw him as a dictator, as somebody who had like ushered in a really dark period. But the poor, some of the middle class really respected him. The thing to remember is that before Chavez, a lot of the country had been excluded from politics for decades. It was a country that was ruled by elites. People who were poor or uneducated felt like there was no room for them. And Chavez came in and really changed that and said, you guys matter. Even if you're not rich, even if your skin is darker, there's a place for you. And that meant a huge amount. By the time I left, people, I think, had really started to turn on Chavez because they saw how the country was collapsing. So when I first got there, I mean, he was almost a saint. But I think these days, it's hard to find people who are still committed to the Chavista revolution in that way.
And based on what you saw, Hannah, reporting on the ground, what institutions failed first, like the courts, the legislature, the media, or was it all crumbling at once?
It's not that Chavez came in and instantly dismantled democracy there. He didn't really need to. He was very popular and he was winning elections outright without having to cheat or kick anybody out of office. And there was sort of this slow transition for a while. People would call it managed democracy, where there were still free and fair elections, but some candidates were barred from running, or the government was sort of bribing people by giving them, you know, a washing machine or a refrigerator to vote for the government candidate. It took a long time for the government to start, I think everybody now agrees, basically stealing elections. But they didn't have to initially because Chavismo was popular. The first things that I really saw start to go were basic availability of food and medicine.
Is there anything you want to point out that is consistently misunderstood to outsiders about how or why Venezuelan democracy fell apart?
While the administration was increasingly repressive, authoritarian, the opposition also was widely mistrusted by a lot of people in Venezuela. People of color, people who are poor, people who are uneducated, the people who sort of haven't had power in Venezuela historically, don't always trust the opposition. The opposition tends to be elites. If you look at them, they don't look the way some other people in the country look. And that dynamic, I think, has been very tricky and is part of the reason why the government has been able to stay in power for so long. And I see it still today with Maria Corina Machado. You know, there's this big gulf of trust that the opposition is going to have to overcome, and I don't know if they're there yet.
Maria Corina Machado, the Nobel Prize winner, was barred from appearing on the 2024 presidential election ballot. Do you think that marked a new stage in Venezuela's democratic erosion or simply confirmed what was already clear to a lot of people?
I think that confirmed what was clear. I mean, Maduro was never going to let another leader come and take power at that point. Maybe one thing it showed was that Maduro knew that the Chavistas knew that they didn't have the popular support at that point to win an election, unlike in past years.
Hannah Dreyer, a reporter from Venezuela for the Associated Press from 2014 to 2017. She's now an investigative reporter with the New York Times. Stay with the world for context and clarity as the dramatic events in Venezuela continue to unfold.
Jamaica is working hard to recover from a hurricane last fall. 2 months ago, Hurricane Melissa brought terrifying winds and storm surges that battered people's homes and destroyed infrastructure across the island. It had been the strongest storm ever to hit Jamaica. But the country's Minister for Tourism, Edmund Bartlett, says that crucial industry is rebounding. Since Melissa's destruction in October, the island has seen 445,000 visitors, injecting nearly $500 million into Jamaica's economy.
In Indonesia, Cyclone Senyar caused widespread devastation just a month ago. Stay with us just ahead as we check on the recovery efforts after that deadly storm. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's been more than a month since a cyclone devastated parts of the Indonesian island of Sumatra. Hundreds of thousands of people are still displaced across three provinces. The storm leveled villages and killed more than 1,100 people, according to official estimates. Aid workers continue to face enormous challenges getting food to remote areas. As Dave Grunebaum reports, scientists say Mother Nature does not deserve all the blame for this disaster.
Floodwaters and landslides damaged or destroyed almost 180,000 homes, thousands of schools, and hundreds of healthcare centers. In the town of Kuala Sumpang in Aceh Province, some homes were flattened, others washed away, and many are buried in thick mud that covers the landscape. Sari Pudin, who, like many Indonesians, only has one word in his full name, sat in what used to be his living room. Now it has a mud-covered floor with no walls and a thin tarp for a roof. Sari Pudin, along with his wife and two children, sleep in a tent provided by the government that's about 18 by 20 feet. So after the flood, we can say about 95% of the homes here were destroyed, he says, and most of the remaining 5% are uninhabitable. While his family struggled during the first week after the storm to get enough to eat, they're okay now. There's a community kitchen set up under a few tents nearby. It serves three meals a day with donated food. On a recent afternoon, two women volunteers cooked up a big pot of soup. These families are more fortunate than others in more remote areas, where bridges collapsed and many roads remain impassable, crippling access to thousands of people in dozens of rural villages.
We cannot distribute the food smoothly because of the difficulty of that situation.
Soraya IT is a senior advisor to Aceh's governor. She shared a video with The World that shows a couple of small riverboats being loaded with instant noodles, rice, eggs, blankets, and clothes, destined for villages cut off by land. Local aid workers are also carrying food and medicine on dirt bikes and even hiking for days to reach remote communities.
So is many people is hunger, many people starving.
The central government did send helicopters to airlift supplies, but IT says not nearly enough. She says some survivors of the cyclone died in the aftermath because humanitarian aid did not reach them in time.
Many people die because of they're not enough food and not enough medicine. That's the problem.
IT says the governor's office asked the country's president, Prabowo Subianto, to declare this crisis a national disaster and ask for aid from foreign governments. But Prabowo has resisted. He recently cracked the door open for non-government organizations from foreign countries to help, but has not allowed foreign governments to work directly on the ground. But IT says Indonesia needs more international help for distributing humanitarian aid, as well as rebuilding roads, schools, and healthcare centers.
So we want actually is how international community can approach our government, particularly central government, to make sure that they open window, they open door for international help and international aid to help Aceh.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be seen as a weak leader.
Made Supriyatma is a visiting fellow in the Indonesia Studies Program at the Yusuf Ishak Institute, a think tank based in Singapore. Supriyatma says President Prabowo sees this crisis through a nationalistic lens and that accepting help from a foreign government would signal that his administration is not up to the challenge.
He always thinks that Indonesia is a great nation, so he's capable of doing this alone without any help.
Prabowo's communications team has not responded to The World's requests for comment. Supriyatma says Prabowo has surrounded himself with too many inexperienced advisors, which has led to the president not receiving the full picture about the severity of the disaster.
What they are doing right now is just denying.
In many communities in Aceh province, people have flown white flags as a form of protest over the central government's response to the disaster, as they wait for electricity to be restored and for better access to clean water. Budiman Manasni is a professor of soil science at the University of Sydney. He says the impact from the cyclone was amplified by decades of deforestation for mining, palm oil plantations, and timber. This led to even more severe flooding and landslides when the cyclone struck, because the forest acts as a protective barrier, soaking up rainfall and strengthening the soil below.
When the soil is saturated, full of water, it naturally becomes weak. If the soil is without any vegetation, then landslides can occur very rapidly because that thing is holding those soils together.
Minasni showed me several satellite images of the three provinces that suffered significant damage: North Sumatra, West Sumatra, and Aceh. In the images, you see a lot of green, but there are also vast patches that are brown.
So the brown is just the surface color of the soil. That means that the soil has been exposed. There's no vegetation on top of this soil.
That's deforestation.
That is deforestation.
Minasni teamed up with researchers at the University of Malaysia Terengganu and Universitas Andalas in Indonesia for an analysis that concluded that across these three provinces, more than 10 million acres of land was deforested during the past four decades. Back in Kuala Sampang, about a mile from Sariputin's home, is where 25-year-old Liza Ananda Putri lives with her parents. Their home is badly damaged, but among a small number still standing. Many of her neighbors' homes were destroyed by timber that was carried downstream into the community when the Tamiang River overflowed its banks. Putri is angry and blames deforestation for the destruction of her neighborhood. She says her neighbors would still have their homes if this wood had not been carried down the river. Several miles away, in a neighboring community, Dr. Dedi Guandis ran a free pop-up health clinic where he checked anyone who stopped by, recording their blood pressure, listening to their breathing, and asking them what health issues they have.
Saya menemukan banyak orang yang pertama sakit.
I found many sick people with acute respiratory infections, digestive problems, high blood pressure, and skin diseases because of the flood, he says. This is normal after a natural disaster. They will definitely get sick because food and sleep are irregular, and people will likely have these problems for the next month. Across the three provinces, cleanup and rebuilding efforts are underway. The president has said activities may return to normal in 2 to 3 months. But given the enormous scale of the damage, many people here are skeptical. For The World, I'm Dave Grunebaum, Kuala Sampang, Indonesia.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. I do not need to tell you that 2025 was a whopper of a year for global news. This year's headlines are not looking much calmer. Just 5 days into the new year, the world already feels changed. Tom Standage predicted as much when we invited him to Future Gaze with us right before the holidays. His predictions for 2026 can be summed up in one word.
Pivotal.
Tom oversees the World Ahead issue for The Economist. He's the magazine's deputy editor. And here's why he expects 2026 to be pivotal.
There's a lot of uncertainty and sort of disruption in the world now. And I think whether you look at geopolitics or economics or markets or trade or technology, there's a lot of sort of unanswered questions. And I think one of the things that we're going to have happen this year is we'll start to get some answers. Where does, you know, the Trump administration stand on China and its allies in Asia? Where is everything going with AI? Is the bubble going to burst? Are we going to have some sort of markets event? You know, what's going to happen with the tariffs? What's going to happen with the trade war? I think the sort of sense of navigating in the fog may dissipate a bit.
Your list of 2026 predictions depict a world that is adapting to disorder rather than really resolving it. In what ways do you see that happening?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it is adaptation, but I think I think when we start to get answers in later this year, I think kind of what happens this year is going to set the path for the next 5 to 10 years. So that's why I say it's pivotal. What we've seen so far is adaptation in various ways to the uncertainty, the geopolitical uncertainty because of the change in policy coming from the White House, also the business and trade and economic uncertainty because of the trade war and the tariffs, and so far. The US economy has done a pretty good job of being resilient in the face of that disruption. Companies have managed to reroute their supply chains. Trade has kept going. It's just the pattern of trade that has changed. So far, there's been quite a lot of adaptability. But I think that adaptability does have a cost, which is that companies and governments, they're spending time dealing with that uncertainty and changing their plans when they'd probably rather be focusing on growth and developing new products and all the things they would normally be doing.
So I want to dig into your list of predictions now and start with the global economy. You seem to think that debt and fiscal pressures in rich countries might come to a head. Does that mean a recession?
One of the other things that people are starting to worry about more is the risk of some sort of bond market crisis. And there are several countries that seem quite vulnerable to this. The one that's been in the news lately has been France. But just generally, if you look across the G7 countries, they are on average running a fiscal deficit of 6% of GDP. So they increased their spending during the pandemic and they haven't ratcheted it back down again. And they're borrowing the difference from the bond markets. That's basically what's happening. One of the big questions for this year is what's going to happen with the new chair of the Federal Reserve, and is that person going to do whatever Donald Trump tells them? That is one of the big questions.
You see who is appointed Fed chair here in the U.S. as really a pivotal point on what happens with the bond markets and thus the financial health of G7 countries writ large. That's a lot of power you're giving one person.
It's not a direct connection to all of the other economies of the G7, but I think the big question is the extent to which central banks around the world can resist politicization, because what we're hearing, and we're getting a version of this in Japan as well, where the new prime minister wants to spend more money and borrow more money. At some point, the bond markets are going to impose fiscal discipline on the governments of the rich world. We haven't got to that point yet, but at some point we're going to get to it. That's going to be a shock. So the prospect of a big serious bond market crisis in the US is still pretty small, but the fact that people are talking about it at all, that is something that is a cause for concern.
Mm. So moving on to a closely related issue, AI. As part of The Economist's look ahead, there's a story with the headline, AI's true impact will become apparent in the coming year. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a few different aspects of the impact of AI. I think one of the possible impacts is that there will be some kind of market correction in the prices, the share prices of the big tech companies.
Feared AI bubble bursting.
Exactly. I think some kind of correction is quite likely. I think the share prices are much too high because they are implying essentially annual revenues at the current rate of CapEx. They're implying that AI annual revenues will be of the order of $650 billion a year. They're currently $50 billion a year, and that's an eighth of an Apple or a Google. So this is, we think of it as this giant industry, but actually the amount of money that is being paid to use AI services at the moment is very small. And it's not growing as fast as investors seem to be expecting. And adoption of AI by companies doesn't seem to be growing as fast as people are expecting. And to be honest, we've seen this movie before. This happened with the internet. Implementing AI means rebuilding processes in an awful lot of companies and rethinking how you do things. And that is going to take years. We're 30 years into the internet revolution now, and we are still seeing the impact of that new technology with, things like the fight over Warner Brothers or whatever, that you've got these new companies like Netflix that come in and shake up the way that big industries work. And we're going to see the same thing with AI, and it's not going to happen overnight. So I'm actually very optimistic about the potential for AI to transform economies, make new things possible. But the history of previous impactful technologies like that, like the railways and electricity and the internet, is that it took much longer than people expected. Mm-hmm. And there were many booms and busts along the way. So I think we are going to have to grapple with reality, that the fantasies of sort of rapid economic transformation that are sustaining those high share prices are probably a bit wider the mark.
And so that is the impact on the financial world and the stock market. What about the impacts on jobs?
So there does seem to have been an uptick in graduate unemployment. And there is a big argument going on about whether this is mainly due to AI or not. It may be that there are multiple factors. You know, lots of companies hired too many people during the pandemic. There's a lot of economic uncertainty, which means that many companies are not hiring people at the rate that they used to. And there's an AI component in there too, probably. But the concern is that this is in particular affecting graduates, and that AI is taking away the bottom rung of the ladder. Now, to be honest, the evidence of this is very thin. But once again, I think we are going to get some clarity on this in the next few months. And so that's an area to watch very closely. And I think whether the bubble bursts or not, the concern about AI's impact on jobs is definitely coming up the agenda.
So I want to focus on China now and how President Trump's America First policies are creating opportunities for Beijing. You specifically highlight opportunities in India. I wonder if you can briefly run us through what you mean there.
There has been a sense that the West was sort of, you know, trying to get India into its camp. And the fact that Donald Trump then slapped these big tariffs on India for buying oil from Russia meant that Narendra Modi, you know, went to a summit in Beijing. But, you know, he also didn't stay for the military parade. So, and India always does what's best for India. And we in the West tend to go, oh, look, it looks like they're coming into our camp. But actually, India is pursuing an India first policy. But more broadly, what I think is happening here is that the retreat from many of its sort of global responsibilities by America, so getting rid of its foreign aid, not saying it won't stand behind its allies, tearing up trade agreements, putting tariffs even on the countries that are meant to be friendly and so on. All of this is an absolute gift to China because it can say we are the adult in the room. And if you want a reliable trade and economic partner, you should go with us, not with America, where, you know, the president changes his mind every 5 minutes. And also China's soft power is growing just as America's soft power is being destroyed. So America used to be the place where people, certainly in Europe, wanted, aspired to go and live and work. And now that sort of image has been tarnished by the attacks by the Trump administration on science funding, on universities, on academic freedom. China's soft power, meanwhile, is growing with the impact of Chinese global brands like TikTok, like the Labubu dolls, like BYD, its leading maker of electric cars. So this is a gap that has been created by America sort of retreating, and in many respects, China is charging into it.
One of your predictions that I hadn't really thought about is weight loss drugs going global. Semaglutide, the active ingredient in drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic, the patent on that runs out in 2026 in countries including Brazil, India, and Turkey. What impact do you see that having?
So, yeah, this is we're really at the beginning of the whole sort of semaglutide GLP-1 revolution, because we're now going to get the second wave of these drugs. And the second wave of drugs are going to be cheaper because lots of drugs are coming off patent. They're going to be more effective. And crucially, there are new versions of these drugs in pill form. And that means that you can distribute them even in parts of the world where you haven't got reliable refrigeration and cold chains for injectable drugs. Mm. So all of this is going to mean that access to these drugs really shoots up. There's going to be much more competition, prices are going to come down, there are going to be more options for people who want to take these drugs.
What are you most optimistic about in the year ahead, Tom?
Well, I think my optimism tends to come from the, these potential upsides from technologies, mRNA vaccines, cancer vaccines, personalized vaccines, that kind of thing. That has been set back by the policies of the new administration in the US, but, you know, those therapies do seem to work, so that's good. And then also on the energy front, I think, you know, the possibility of new energy technologies in the short term are being driven by the AI companies looking for new sources of energy. But if they do manage to unlock these new innovations, then we've obviously got that for the rest of time. So those are, I think, things to be optimistic about.
So on the flip side, what big geopolitical risk do you think is maybe somewhat hidden or underestimated right now?
The big unresolved geopolitical question at the moment, the thing we don't really know, is where Trump stands on China and Taiwan. We're getting mixed signals from the administration. And there's going to be this summit between Trump and Xi in April. And what I think we're worried about and a concern that we express in the world ahead is that if the US economy is in trouble and you know, Trump wants to do a deal to get China to buy more soybeans and more airliners or whatever, that China's price on that might be, yes, we'll do that, but we want you to change your position, change your language on Taiwan. And, you know, Trump has been quite dismissive about the importance of defending Taiwan in the past. So I think that's, you know, we could get a shocking answer in that area. We could get a very America first, Taiwan last kind of outcome. Who knows? But I mean, that is really the big unresolved geopolitical question about America's foreign policy. And so I think we'll all be watching that very closely.
We will stay tuned and watch what happens in April. Tom Standage is Deputy Director of The Economist and the editor of its World Ahead 2026 issue. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you very much.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed. North Korea announced that it has conducted test flights of a hypersonic missile over the weekend. That comes a day after South Korea detected missile launches, which it alleged were provocations by the North. A functioning hypersonic missile would give North Korea the ability to penetrate the U.S. and South Korea's missile defense systems. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said the test marked the completion of a, quote, very important technology task for national defense.
A Europe-bound boat carrying more than 200 migrants capsized off the coast of Gambia in West Africa on New Year's Eve. That prompted a search and rescue operation by emergency services and local fishermen in the region. At least seven people have died, according to Gambian President Adama Barrow.
Syria has begun to update its currency, the Syrian pound. President Ahmad al-Sharaa decreed last week that the old paper money will be gradually withdrawn from circulation and replaced with new banknotes. The government announced on state TV that the new notes will remove two zeros from the nominal value of the old ones. That means 100 pounds in the old currency will equal 1 pound in the new currency. The change aims to stabilize the local economy and help with inflation.
And those are a few things you might have missed.
In parts of England, today is a day to roam from house to house, singing in exchange for food and drink, especially wassail, a hot spice punch. The alcoholic drink made from apples, citrus, and winter spices is easy to recreate here in the U.S. with or without the roaming bands of tipsy singers. Jacob Aloy from Minnesota Public Radio reports.
If you like old English Christmas carols like me, you might be familiar with the Gloucestershire wassail, sung here by the music group Vocal Essence. But what exactly is wassailing? Well, it's a centuries-old English tradition similar to caroling.
Well, originally this was tended to be the farmers, and they would gather together and go up to the manor house.
That's Jake Endress, a Minnesota theater artist who knows quite a bit about wassailing. He says these farmers would sing to the lord of the manor and expected to be rewarded with food, alcohol, or sometimes money.
So it reminds me a lot of Halloween. But it ties in with this whole concept of that we rarely get to do anymore, where basically neighbors get to go and visit other neighbors and sing to them. And so there's very few times in our current culture where we get to do that.
I really like how Endress put that. It's an opportunity to greet your neighbors. So if you're interested in hosting a wassailing party, here's some things to keep in mind. You should probably get some carols together to sing that are specifically about wassailing. These include the Gloucestershire wassail, the Somerset wassail, and Here We Come A-Wassailing. But feel free to bring along other favorites. Importantly, though, you'll have to make wassail. It's a kind of hot punch that comes in a wide variety, and it contains a lot of spices like cinnamon and ginger. Luckily, Dan O'Dell, the bar manager at W.A. Frost & Company in St. Paul, has a tip when making a drink with these spices.
You know, some of the hard spices that are used can, like, you gotta be, kind of balance them, you know, because they can really overpower things pretty easily. Like, just a touch of sweetness or something, it kind of, like, takes it over the top, in my opinion.
That's quite a production.
Fun. I'm excited.
Okay, cool. Alrighty.
To perfect my version of a wassail, I enlisted my friend and fellow NPR news reporter, Kyra Miles.
So, I've never made this before.
Okay.
And it has like there's like a million different ways that this is made.
The recipe I'm riffing off of has you start by roasting apples in the oven. And while that's going, on the stovetop, you add your alcohol to the pot. We tried both cider and beer, but the cider version turned out much better. Next, you add in your spices. I recommend cinnamon, ginger, clove, nutmeg, and brown sugar. Once everything is mixed in and hot, you can add in your roasted apples and a sliced lemon.
That's not bad. I'm not gonna lie, I think I like this better than mulled wine.
That's a pretty glowing endorsement, I think. But wassail is meant to be shared. So I brought it along to a holiday party, and it was a hit, especially when served in exchange for a song. For the world, I'm Jacob Aloy in St. Paul.
Ukraine's leadership is fighting the Russian military, and it is also fighting an ongoing corruption scandal. That has forced President Volodymyr Zelensky to replace much of his cabinet. One of the new inner circle is the former Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. We asked Andriy Borovik to walk through these changes. He's head of the corruption watchdog group Transparency International Ukraine in Kyiv.
There is a new head of the chief of staff within the presidential office, Mr. Budanov. He has a very good reputation within the defense and security sector, within the military and international agenda, as I know. Also, there is expected another change within the Ministry of Defense. Now it's led by Mr. Shmigal, who previously, before summer last year, he was a prime minister. He will be moved to the position of the Minister of Energy, which is vacant now after the scandal that happened back in November with the nuclear plant. And the new Minister of Defense will be Mr. Fedorov, who's currently is the Vice Prime Minister and the Minister of Digital Transformation.
And that scandal you mentioned was a lot of money being embezzled from the nuclear power sector by higher-ups in Zelensky's inner circle.
This is about that scandal, and as a result of that scandal, two ministers lost their jobs, Minister of Energy and Minister of Justice. Now, at least publicly, we know who will be proposed as the Minister of Energy. When we are waiting, I think in the next couple of days, we will find out who will be the next Minister of Justice. And also, ex-head of Chief of Staff of the Presidential Office also lost his position. But now this vacancy is now filled with Mr. Budanov.
Perhaps the most eye-catching choice of a new minister or cabinet member for Zelensky is Chrystie Freeland. She's the former deputy prime minister and finance minister in Canada. Can you tell us why she is being brought in, what she is being brought in to do?
Oh, it was a complete surprise for me as well. She's appointed as an economic advisor to the president. Let's see how much influence she will has. But I think it's definitely positive for us. I just hope that this is not just a nominal appointment, but a real one. And Ms. Freeland will be, I'm sure she can be, very useful for Ukraine and for our economy.
Mm. What does her appointment, taken with the other new appointments we've been talking about, tell you about President Zelensky's priorities here?
I think that his priorities currently, despite the appointment of Ms. Freeland, it's a war and international relations. With all these negotiations, with involvement of the U.S., I think this should still stay the main thing for the president. That's what he declared many times, and that definitely is the number one priority for him, because he's strengthening now the military side and the diplomatic side within his office and also within the cabinet of ministers, with the appointment of the new Minister of Defense, who's more oriented on our tech warfare rather than on old school Soviet style management.
Mm. So higher tech warfare could be an angle the Defense Department might be leaning into more heavily.
Yes, and also just to let you know that the future Minister of Defense, who is currently Minister of Digital Transformation, he was leading different digital projects within the military sector during the last 3-4 years of the war, and he might bring some fresh new view on how it can be done more efficiently and more in a more modern way than it is done now.
You've said that the priorities here are clearly still the war effort. Do these changes in Zelensky's cabinet play into the ongoing peace negotiations at all?
I think they have their own strategy how to deal with that. And I think that if the chief of staff, current one, will be involved in this, and I'm more than sure that he will, because he has very good experience during the last 4 years in different negotiation formats that were happening in different levels. I think it will bring more strength to the Ukrainian side, and of course I'm happy about that.
We've seen trust in and support for Zelensky change among Ukrainians over the course of the war. How much support does he have right now?
He's still the most popular politician in Ukraine. He's still the leader of the country that is fighting in war. Of course, the level of those people who have a negative opinion about him is also growing because of these corruption scandals. But he still has a high level of support compared to many others. Yeah, and I think it is important to have a leader during the war who is supported by the people.
You are the head of the corruption watchdog Transparency International. How would you rate these changes that are being made now in terms of efforts toward transparency and against corruption?
Oh, it's very hard to evaluate because I see them more in the international and security side. But here are Minister of Justice and the Parliament are the two key players in proposing the amendments to our current legislation in order to bring country closer to the European Union. And just becoming the member of the EU because of the political decisions of somebody, I doubt that it will happen. We need to do the reforms. We need to develop new legislation and rules. And that's for when these two players are the major ones. So our anti-corruption fight is ongoing and they are progressing.
Andriy Borovik is head of the corruption watchdog Transparency International Ukraine. He spoke to us from Kyiv.
A final note for you before we sign off. A bluefin tuna fetched a record-breaking $3.2 million today at a fish auction in Tokyo. Japanese entrepreneur Kiyoshi Kimura was the buyer. He owns a chain of sushi restaurants in Japan.
The price went up and up and up, Kimura said. It was like being on a roller coaster ride. That is partially because of the fish's size. It weighed in at a massive 535 pounds. That is more than double the average Pacific bluefin tuna.
But the super high selling price is also due to scarcity. The bluefin tuna population is still recovering from historic overfishing. When these fish are sold at auction, the tails are cut off so bidders can examine the color, texture, and fattiness of the meat. A perfect layer of fat is what drew Kimura to this particular specimen. I haven't tried it myself yet, but I bet it would be good, he told reporters.
So far, customers who have tasted sushi from the record-breaking tuna told the AFP news agency they are impressed by its richness and texture. Eating something so auspicious at the start of the new year, I feel I've welcomed a good year.
Here's to the rest of 2026 turning out as good as that $3.2 million tuna.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.